Hello there. Today is Tuesday, April 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a whistleblower says Trump aides gave security clearances after reviewers rejected them over an array of concerns.
This broke with previous protocol, that if there was, you know, problems in someone's background, that was generally accepted to be a reason for denying a clearance.
President Trump threatens to close the U.S. border with Mexico. How seniors are using marijuana to help with ailments and insomnia. And the movie that's been such a huge hit, there's now a musical based on the band Queen. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the Trump administration is intensifying measures to curb the flow of Central American asylum seekers crossing into the United States from Mexico. Officials say that includes sending more people back to Mexico to wait for their asylum claims to be heard by U.S. courts. Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen said U.S. Customs and Border Patrol or Protection Agency will be speeding up reassignment of 750 officers to parts of the border dealing with the largest number of immigrants, a shift the administration first announced last week. President Donald Trump has threatened to close the border if Mexico doesn't stop a purge of people, often traveling as families from Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. The administration also says the president is considering cutting off millions of dollars in aid to those three countries. Any plan, though, to cut aid from Central America would face strong objections from members of Congress who must approve Trump's plan for it to become effective. Joining us to talk about the impacts these policies could have is Adam Isaacson, co-manager of the Border Security Program with the Washington Office for Latin America. What say you about, first off, you know, closing off the entire border?
I imagine that he means closing down all the ports of entry. There are 45 land crossings, official land crossings across the border, and just stopping all traffic. Whether that would mean pedestrian and commercial traffic, we don't know. But assume it's everything. You would strand people on one side of the border. You would have inventories, including agricultural inventories, go rotten. You would cost billions of dollars in lost investment. You would see prices of many goods immediately rise on the United States side of the border. You would, however, not see any significant decrease in the number of Central American kids and families who cross the border and stand on U.S. soil and wait to be apprehended so that they can then ask for asylum. It's very easy to wade across the Rio Grande in El Paso, where it's narrow. It's very easy to climb over the fence in San Diego and just wait for Border Patrol to come, as many are doing. And that for those folks, it won't matter whether the ports of entry are open or not. That seems to be what has the president so angry, is these Central American kids and families, and closing the ports of entry is irrelevant.
Is it true that we do have a crisis?
It is definitely a crisis. If you add it up, by the end of this year, at least 1% of the entire population of Guatemala and Honduras will have been apprehended at the U.S.-Mexico border. That's pretty staggering, but it is a humanitarian crisis. A crisis of people suffering and so desperate that they're willing to uproot themselves and come here in massive numbers. It is not a border security crisis. It doesn't really represent much of a threat to our national security. And it is something that is administratively manageable if we were to build up our ports of entry, have decent monitoring programs, alternatives to detention programs, and have more judges to try these cases more quickly.
Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen is now calling for the migrants that come in to be sent back over the border to Mexico.
Right.
How would that work?
Since December, there's been a program that Homeland Security calls a migrant protection protocols, but everybody else calls remain in Mexico, where some families who are asking for asylum are being sent back into Mexico. Central American families asking for asylum are being sent back to Mexico, where they have a date on which they will be allowed back into the United States just to attend their hearings. And then they'll have to go back into Mexico while their asylum cases are considered and tried. Mexico did not agree to this. They say it was a unilateral decision of the United States, but they're so far agreeing to accept some of the Central Americans. So far, this has only remain in Mexico has only been applied to something like 350 to 400 Central Americans. But what Secretary Nielsen announced Monday is their plan, at least, is to ramp it up to hundreds of people a day. Now, if that happens, this is hundreds of basically homeless Central Americans they're going to send back into Mexico. Mexico, where they might not even have family ties, to await their trials. If it's hundreds per day, it'll overwhelm whatever shelter capacity there is on the Mexican side immediately. You're going to start seeing refugee camps. You're going to start seeing tent cities. If you have actually hundreds of people a day in towns like Ciudad Juarez or Nogales or Mexicali, there won't be any place to put those Central Americans while they wait for courts to get around to hearing their cases. And it's going to cause a humanitarian emergency, a more severe one than we're seeing.
What do you think about the president's threats to cut hundreds of millions of dollars of aid to the Central American nations where these migrants are coming from?
The president's threats to cut aid to Central America are completely counterproductive and nonsensical. The aid was mostly going not to the governments of Central America, which have problems administering the aid. It was going to non-governmental organizations. It was going to anti-crime programs. It was going to police and judicial reform efforts. And stopping those will simply worsen conditions in some of the very communities that are expelling migrants right now. So it's not clear who Trump is punishing here. The whole idea of a lot of this aid, which was increased in the last few years, was to improve conditions so that people, the push factors sending people out of Central America would eventually start to improve. It's a slow motion process. But without that assistance, without those investments, some neighborhoods and some villages that would send a lot of migrants out but aren't now because they were getting assistance, they're going to start sending a lot of migrants out.
That's Adam Isaacson, co-manager of the Border Security Program with the Washington Office for Latin America. A whistleblower from inside the White House has told congressional investigators that senior Trump administration officials granted national security clearances to at least 25 people that government reviewers had rejected for an array of concerns and disqualifying issues in their backgrounds. AP correspondent Chad Day reports it's not yet known when the names will be out.
They found there were problems in their background that suggested that they should not have access to classified information. And so they made that decision, but then they were overruled by political appointees within the White House.
The whistleblower, Tricia Newbold, an 18-year veteran of the security clearance process, said the officials cleared for security credentials after career employees recommended they be denied, including two current unnamed senior White House officials, government contractors, and other staff aides working for the office of the president of Donald Trump.
This broke with previous protocol that if there was, you know, problems in someone's background, that was generally accepted to be a reason for denying a clearance. But in this case, what she's saying is that she saw things that were troubling within the White House where they were not taking this into account and were being overruled.
Newbold also told investigators she'd been suspended for 14 days without pay earlier this year after protesting internally about the way the security clearance denials had been overturned, and now she was worried about returning to work since she decided to go public with her concerns. Joining us to get some insight into what has happened here is Jamil Jaffer, founder of the National Security Institute. How unprecedented is this situation?
Well, I mean, it is unusual for the original adjudicator's decision to be overruled. The way a security clearance process works is, you know, you go through an extensive background check, you fill out all sorts of paperwork, and then there's a person who's assigned to your case file, and they interview you, and then they file a report, and then that whole packet, the interview report, all the review of your materials, all the review of your connections, it then goes to an adjudicator, a person who makes a decision, or at least a recommendation to the ultimate decision maker. And that ultimate decision maker can make a decision. They sometimes have bosses, and those bosses can override the decision. And ultimately, the final authority, I think everyone agrees, on a security clearance is the president, because it ultimately derives from his authority or her authority to classify national security information. But it is unusual for an adjudicator's decision to be overturned, but not unheard of.
My understanding is that, sure, it happens now and then with different administrations where there may be one person or two people that have some issues that are questionable, could be a past drug offense. But when there are issues related to national security that led to the decisions of denying their clearances, that in and of itself was alarming, much less the fact that it wasn't one or two people, that it was 25.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know. We don't have the details on who these 25 were. We know that there were allegedly two senior White House officials. We also don't know what the circumstances were. And we don't know in prior administrations how many individuals have been either denied or had their security clearance decisions overturned and were provided clearance. It seems like a lot in the abstract, certainly, but without having metrics to know what that compares to, it's really hard to assess how big a problem this is. Now, certainly, we know in the case of Jared Kushner, we've heard a lot of talk about that, and there's been a lot of controversy about that particular security clearance. And again, we don't yet have all the facts yet, but certainly there's a lot of focus on that particular security clearance and the decision made, particularly given that it looks like, if you believe the allegations from a few months back, that both the White House counsel and the White House chief of staff, both people very close to the president, recommended that Mr. Kushner not be given a clearance.
A House Oversight and Reform Committee Chair Elijah Cummings said it is reviewing the clearances that were given to the president's daughter, Ivanka Trump, her husband, Jared Kushner, as you just mentioned, and also National Security Advisor John Bolton.
Chairman Cummings has now issued his first subpoena. They're going to vote to subpoena Carl Klein, who is the personal security director at the White House, to evaluate these concerns raised by Ms. Tricia Newbold, who worked for Mr. Klein. She says that he overturned a number of her decisions in the personnel security process and then was disciplined for objecting to that. And that's her claim on the table. So we'll see whether, in fact, the committee votes to issue these subpoenas, and if it does, what comes out of those subpoenas. But certainly, you know, obviously an issue that's been around for a while now with the administration, particularly when it comes to Mr. Kushner. His security clearance was held up for a long time. He had an interim clearance for a while, and then ultimately was granted a final top secret clearance.
I think there were concerns, particularly about his connections with foreign countries. But even if the president is theoretically allowed to overrule the clearances, does it still present a problem with ethics or particularly when the clearance was denied due to national security concerns and also because of the fact that these are family members of the president?
I think there's sort of two separate issues, right? Oftentimes in this particular scenario with Jared Kushner, we have a lot of times see these ethics questions and the security questions get conflated, right? On the security clearance side, I think the law and the prior practice is very clear on this. The president has ultimate authority. He can decide whether to grant a security clearance or revoke a security clearance, and it's an unreviewable decision. It's also tied, you know, to the president's ultimate authority to classify information, so the president can immediately declassify information on the fly if he chooses to, because it is ultimately his commander-in-chief authority that is the root of classification or declassification. So the idea somehow that the president acts inappropriately by declassifying information or by classifying it as long as it's within the regular bounds of it, I think everyone agrees he can do it. Now, whether he ought to do it is a different question, and that's where it gets tangled with this ethics issue, because the claim about Jared Kushner has been that it has largely been not that he would necessarily have these foreign ties that would cause him to give up information to another nation state. That hasn't really been, as far as I can tell, the claim on the table. The bigger concern is that he might use the information in a way to benefit his own interests or his family's interests, or that he might use it to ingratiate himself in some way. Typically, the way that's dealt with in the government ethics process is that people are required to separate themselves from their financial interests. They put their assets in a blind trust that they don't know what's happening to them. And that's one of the pieces that hasn't happened here. And that is part of why the ethics issue has become intertwined with the security clearance issue. And we see a little bit of a challenge here in that space. A lot of this problem could go away. The ethics concerns that are raised by having financial interests at stake could be solved.
That's Jamil Jaffer, founder of the National Security Institute. House Democrats are preparing to ramp up efforts to get the special counsel's full Russia report. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Democrats had set a deadline tomorrow to get the full report. The Justice Department appears likely to miss it, and the following day, the House Judiciary Committee will vote to authorize subpoenas to get the report. Attorney General William Barr has released a four-page summary and says he'll put out a scrubbed version of the full report by mid-month. Democrats, though, want the whole thing, unfiltered by Barr. He'd written the special counsel found no Trump campaign coordination with Russia, but he also went further than Bob Mueller by saying there's not enough evidence to prove the president obstructed the Russia investigation. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Venezuelan Chief Justice seeks to strip opposition leaders' immunity. Algeria's Bouteflika to resign this month. Brexit deadlocked again. The British Parliament fails to find an alternative. And neonatal cuddlers help babies get a good start. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has suffered his worst electoral setback, with his AKP party losing control of the capital, Ankara, and apparently set to lose Istanbul in Sunday's local elections. The losses have damaged Erdogan's reputation of electoral invincibility. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
An AKP poster celebrating success, perhaps a little prematurely. President Erdogan and his mayoral candidate, Binali Yildirim, thanking Istanbul for victory. But it's the opposition CHP candidate, Ekrem İmamoğlu, who apparently has the votes and is claiming victory in Istanbul, albeit with a wafer-thin margin of victory. Istanbul's Üsküdar district is home to Erdogan and a stronghold of his AKP party. Some AKP supporters say Yildirim won.
Istanbul is won by Yildirim. With God's will, he will be confirmed.
But others admit defeat.
They are defeated because they couldn't hit their targets with some of their programs. They lost because of the economic and political situation, as well as unemployment.
Just down the road from Üsküdar is Kadıköy, a stronghold of the opposition CHP. CHP banners celebrate victory. People here are already looking to a new future.
I think the result was unexpected by the people. It is an election that will be talked about for a long time to come. The AK party won the polls for many years, but I think now a change has happened, and I believe this change will be good for people.
Istanbul is the industrial, financial, and cultural capital of Turkey, and traditionally provides the impetus for political change, according to analysts.
Istanbul changing hands with elections after a quarter of a century will bring excitement to the opposition and will have from now on a lasting impact in Turkish political life.
Given the importance of Istanbul for the AKP, Yildirim continues to challenge the result. However, in AKP strongholds like Üsküdar, some are calling for reconciliation rather than confrontation.
We are all brothers. This is not a war, whether it's a vote for the prime minister or the municipal mayor. I wish for our country just to live peacefully under one flag.
How the disputed Istanbul vote is resolved will be key to determining whether Turkey's political divide continues to deepen. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
The global fleet of Boeing 737 aircraft remains grounded as the investigation continues into last month's crash of an Ethiopian Airlines jetliner, which killed 157 people on board. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with aviation expert Robert Mann Jr. for more on the implications and impact the crash has and will have on the bottom line for airlines using this type of plane.
You have a fleet that's been grounded. At some airlines, that's a small percentage of their total fleet. At other airlines, it's a larger percentage. So the effect on any individual airline is more or less proportional to the extent to which that airplane is significant in their fleets. Airlines are usually able to recapture some of the revenue off of canceled flights. Since they're not flying some of these flights, they have some savings associated.
And of course, any revenue that can't be recaptured is a dead loss. How long do you think these Boeing fleets will be grounded?
The situation, if it was merely a technical issue, would be a matter of weeks, not months. And I say that because the technical issue has already been identified, and tragically, it was already identified before the Ethiopian crash, but it had not yet been approved or implemented. But since it's now become a political issue, timeline might be on the order of months.
I thought all this was just a safety issue. Why are politics involved?
In a case where aircraft are being manufactured, the country or the world region in which they are manufactured generally takes the lead in determining the airworthiness of an aircraft. So in the U.S. market, it's the FAA within the Department of Transportation. In Europe, it's something called EASA, E-A-S-A. Typically, the oversight agency that's primary on the aircraft makes that determination and others follow. But what we have in a case with the 737 is that many countries and some airlines chose to act to ground the aircraft before FAA did. China, in particular, was among the lead countries to ground the aircraft, and a number of others followed. So the politics of this issue now become, will any of these countries or carriers outside of the U.S. take FAA's word for it, if you will, that Boeing's proposed fixes are necessary, appropriate, as proposed, and should be implemented as proposed. That injects some uncertainty into whether and how soon the aircraft may be considered airworthiness outside of the U.S.
What about from the air passengers' point of view? Do you think people will feel comfortable flying in these Boeings once the FAA says the fixes have been made?
I don't say this callously, but it's a fact that most customers don't know what kind of aircraft they're flying on, and as a result, you know, they really look for schedule and price as the method of choosing the airline.
Well, then, do you think this accident could result in a worldwide downturn in air travel, no matter the aircraft? That long-term, people may tend just to either stay home near their house or to drive or take a train just for safety purposes?
No, I don't think so. Again, as tragic as any incident is, the rate of such incidents around the world is so vanishingly small. You're actually exposed to far more danger by driving yourself than you are by flying.
Any comment on Ethiopian Airlines and the worldwide perception of Africa as a trustworthy brand or not?
There are a lot of places around the world where I, as a passenger, would choose not to fly on an indigenous airline. I'll be candid about that, because I know enough about aviation oversight in some parts of the world that I would just not do it. I won't roll those dice. But that was certainly not the case with Ethiopian, which is a first-rate operator, and I think highly regarded around the world, not just on the continent. These are folks who have done it right for 70 years, grown a really important business, not only for the nation, but for the regional economy. And still, unfortunately, this sort of a tragedy befell an industry leader.
All right, that is VOA's Adam Phillips speaking with aviation expert Robert Mann Jr. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, once stigmatized and banned across the United States, marijuana is now legalized in many parts of the country, primarily for medicinal use, but increasingly also for recreation. And as cannabis becomes mainstream, Americans in their 70s and 80s who used it to get high on marijuana in their youth are now using cannabis-infused products to relieve old age aches and pains. VOA's Zlatika Hope reports on this.
A group of senior citizens from Laguna Woods Village, an upscale retirement community in Southern California, make a monthly bus trip to a cannabis dispensary in Santa Ana, where they enjoy lunch, play bingo, and get a supply of marijuana.
I run. I like to run around, and started having issues with my knees, and somebody suggested, well, why don't you try smoking pot? It will help with your joint issues.
People ages 65 and older are the fastest growing group interested in using marijuana. Some of them smoked pot in their youth.
I used to do it when I was like 18, 19, 20, and had a baby, got married, and stopped doing it. I missed it at times, but after a while you just kind of grow out of it, and then you kind of get to a certain age and you're relaxed and you have time. Everybody up was doing it again.
The Bud and Bloom Cannabis Dispensary in Santa Ana provides free bus service for the seniors, as well as instruction on safe use of the weed.
We have to be very cognizant of the fact that it can interact with certain other medications. And so if an elderly person, or really anybody, is on multiple pharmaceuticals, blood thinners, seizure medications, and the list goes on, they really should have a physician looking at potential drug interactions so that person does not end up in an emergency room with an issue.
Experts say more research is needed on marijuana in general, but most agree that appropriate use can alleviate some of the problems associated with old age, such as sleeplessness, tension, arthritis, back pain, stiff muscles, and moodiness. With marijuana entering mainstream America, there is a growing industry of cannabis-linked products, such as pipes, ashtrays, vaping pens, cannabis oil, candy, and others.
It just shows that weed has permeated the full spectrum of society. You know, like in 3 years, it's gone from, I mean, you know, even 2 years ago, you'd go to dispensaries here in California, and you'd feel like you were visiting a parole officer.
Marijuana is still banned by federal law, but California and about 10 other U.S. states have legalized the drug for recreational as well as medicinal use. Zlatica Hoek, VOA News, Washington.
This is Science in a Minute.
It is expected that one day in the future, people will touch down and walk on Mars. There are also those such as Elon Musk of SpaceX who are working on ways to build and maintain human colonies on the red planet. But there are a number of challenges that block the pathway for human exploration of our planetary neighbor. A group of experts recently met in London to discuss the social and psychological aspects of traveling to and living on Mars. According to the meeting's lead organizer, Federico Caprotti of the University of Exeter, the biggest hurdles to Mars settlement are not technical but psychological. Those attending the meeting discussed such issues as humans developing interplanetary jet lag, the lack of the ability to be able to communicate in real time with Earth, and, of course, the inevitable personality clashes between members of the colony. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide, no escape from reality.
A musical inspired by the music of Queen is preparing for a North American tour following the popularity and success of the Academy Award-winning movie about the band, Bohemian Rhapsody. Producers announcing on Monday that the show We Will Rock You will open in Winnipeg, Canada in September and then move into other cities including New York, Los Angeles, Denver, and Las Vegas. Producers say the musical is a futuristic story about Queen hits such as Bohemian Rhapsody, We Are the Champions, and We Will Rock You. They say it will reflect the scale and spectacle that marked Queen's live performances. Casting for the tour is now underway.
Put a gun against his head, pulled my trigger, now he's dead. Mama, life had just begun.
And you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today, but find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
If I'm not back again this time tomorrow, carry on, carry on. Nothing really matters. Too late. My time has come. Sent shivers down my spine. Body's aching all the time. Goodbye, everybody. I've got to go. Gotta leave you all behind and face the truth. Mama. Lightning, very, very frightening me.
Galileo, Galileo, Galileo.
Galileo,
Galileo, Piccolo,
Magnifico.
I'm just a poor boy and nobody loves me.
He's just a poor boy from a poor family. Spare him his life from this monstrosity.
This is VOA News.